Hi, Ruby Ryder here. Welcome to Pegging Paradise podcast number 240 on June 17th, 2019. So this is not going to be a regular type of podcast. Isn't it fun how I surprise you guys all the time? First of all, you can hear my voice is a little bit sick. I'm getting over a cold that has lasted way too long. I caught this cold when I was up in San Francisco on an adventure, and there I was in San Francisco in a luxury hotel room, and I had a cold, and it was International Whores Day, June 2nd. What is International Whores Day? International Whores Day, or International Sex Workers Day, is observed annually on June 2nd of every year, and it honors sex workers and recognizes their often exploited working conditions. The event commemorates the occupation of Église Saint-Nizier in Lyon, which is a beautiful church in Lyon, France, by more than 100 sex workers on June 2nd in 1975. They did this to draw attention to their inhumane working conditions. It has been celebrated annually since 1976. In Germany, it is known as Hurentag, which is Whore's Day. In Spanish-speaking countries, it is the Día Internacional de la Trabajadora Sexual, which is the International Day of the Sex Worker. So, what's the history here? In the 1970s, the French police kept sex workers under increasing pressure, and the police reprisals forced sex workers to work increasingly in secret. As a result, protection of sex workers decreased and led to more violence against them. After two murders and the unwillingness of the government to improve the situation, sex workers in Lyon occupied the Saint-Nizier church in Rue de Brest and went on strike. The striking workers sang political chants, demanded decent working conditions, and an end to the stigma. The police cleared out the church after 8 days, but the event marks the starting point of an international movement of sex workers for sex workers' rights. What other days have to do with stuff like this? Well, there's also March 3rd, which is International Sex Workers' Rights Day, and December 17th, which is the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. So this piece that I'm going to read you next was inspired by Dan Savage. You know, I get a lot of inspiration from Dan Savage. And before I read you what I wrote, let me give you a little bit of history here. You guys have all heard me talk about Sesta Fosta a fair amount, but I'm still kind of amazed how few people actually know what Sesta Fosta is when I say, so you know that law that passed in January, you know, the Sesta Fosta thing? And they really don't. They haven't heard anything about it. It was a thing that flew by and passed with total bipartisan support in both houses because it was framed as something to stop sex trafficking, and all of the posters of the little children crying and things like that were used to push this thing through. So, okay, what actually happened with Sesta Fosta? I'm going to kind of read you a condensed version of an article I found online, and the article does contain the paragraph which inspired me to write my next piece, and I'll read that at the end of this podcast. But first of all, let's check out what Sesta Fosta is and what's happened since it got passed. So, turns out it wasn't passed in January, it was passed in March, and that was back in 2018. And the Sex Traffickers Act and Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, that's what we're talking about here. They said it would reduce sex trafficking online. Instead, what's happened is it's kind of neutered the internet. It really has, because it's caused the shutdown of public forums where people used to discuss sex education and sex worker safety. It's made sex workers much more vulnerable to traffickers and has made actual sex trafficking much more difficult to track. So the bill holds online companies liable for any user content that could possibly be seen as facilitating sex work. Previous to the bill, individual web users were legally responsible for what they posted. Now, any number of company employees could face like up to 10 years in federal prison if their platform hosts anything that, quote, facilitates sex work or sex trafficking, end quote. So it's a really broadly written law that could affect any adult-oriented businesses, including those that market sexual films and forums advocating sex work legalization. The law basically states that state and federal governments have the ability to shut down any sites they don't like in the name of preventing trafficking. So online companies don't have the time or the technology to effectively filter out all of this potentially now illegal content, and it would take a really expensive and powerful form of artificial intelligence to even detect it, and teams of lawyers to handle any potential lawsuits if anything slips through. So instead of paying for all this, most businesses have just decided to shut down any forums for sex or dating. Others have chosen to ban any and all, quote, adult content, end quote, including discussion boards, and they've created rules forbidding sexual comments. So here's some of the things you may have noticed in your travelings around the internet. Tumblr went down, and they committed a mass purge of all adult content. Craigslist took down its personal ads. The hookup app Scruff told users they can't post any racy images. Facebook created new guidelines censoring any discussion of users' sex lives. And Instagram censored historic art and advertisements for many sex-oriented ventures, including Dan Savage's LGBTQ-inclusive adult film festival Hump. So in addition to all of this, what happened in the sex work world was that consensual sex workers had their advertising platforms immediately shut down, making many homeless or unable to provide for their families. SESTAFOSTA has impacted the ability of sex work advocates to serve their communities as well, because anybody who assists a sex worker can be termed a sex trafficker by the law. So if they provide safety information, moral support, or information, they could be prosecuted. Also, as soon as Backpage went down, which is where a lot of sex workers used to advertise, sex workers got emails from people looking to become their pimps, essentially. So the law actually helped sex trafficking because it moved consensual sex work from digital spaces back to the streets and the back alleys. So down at South by Southwest this year, 2019, there was a panel who was talking about this. Because it affects the internet, affects sex workers, it's basically kind of censored the whole freaking internet, and it's a pain in the ass. One of the things in this article that I am pulling all these facts from made me really pay attention, as I mentioned that Dan Savage was on this panel. So let me read you this last part here. Ultimately, everyone on the South by Southwest panel agreed about the need to decouple sex workers from sex trafficking victims, because the public at large doesn't understand the difference. Savage thinks sex workers need to come out because they're also working as nannies, agricultural laborers, and many other professions. These people are then stigmatized when they try and share their stories of being taken advantage of. So to reduce that stigma, he'd like them to start sharing their stories en masse, though he realizes that could subject them to social stigma and criminal prosecution. The sooner sex workers and non-sex workers go into spaces saying, I do this work or I support sex work, and here's why, the sooner we can start changing negative public attitudes and misunderstanding towards sex workers. Okay, so there's my inspiration. There's the history. Now I'm going to read you the piece that I wrote. Some of you have already read this. I put it up on my blog and I put it up on all my social platforms. But I know there's a fair amount of you who really don't pay much attention to that, and you're just podcast people. And I really wanted to spread the word all over the place. So here you go. This is what I posted on June 2nd, 2019, International Whores Day. The title is, Yes, I Am a Sex Worker. International Whores Day 2019, a view into my world. I check my mail, look at my calendar, and think about tomorrow's appointment. He's a sweet client who I've established a close connection with since he first came to see me almost 2 years ago. His last email said he was looking forward to feeling my hand, my paddle, my cock, and even a few strokes of my cane if I felt that was necessary. He comes to me to explore the other side of his sexuality, to revel and play in new exciting experiences. He enjoys the way I interweave pain and pleasure with a healthy dose of teasing throughout it all. His work takes him to faraway places, When he travels, he sends me emails of longing, eloquently expressing his desire to once again place himself in my hands. I pull up my notes. Yes, I keep notes. I'm a professional. I check which toy I fucked him with during his last visit and how he liked it. I check his preferences regarding firm toys or softer toys, and the intensity with which I used my hand, paddle, cock, and occasionally, cane. I check to make sure everything is clean and ready for his arrival tomorrow. Yes, he's married. Yes, he's reasonably happy in that marriage, and yes, they do have a tacit agreement that he can discreetly and safely explore his desires. Coming to see me puts a skip in his step, a smile on his face, and some titillation in his otherwise quite happy and comfortable, but lacking in sexual excitement, life. Next week, I have an appointment scheduled with a client who, when I touch him with tenderness and intention, simply melts. His life as a single successful male in this society offers so little touch. He's hungry for it when he arrives. I always offer him a long, lingering hug, which he accepts and revels in. When I fuck him, I lay on top of him and let him feel the pressure of my body against his, holding him down, having my way with him. He swoons. After reading Mark Green's work about how men in our society are touch-starved, I began touching my clients a lot more, and they universally welcomed it with a hunger that surprised me. I was also surprised to discover how many of them, when questioned, hungered for contact despite being partnered. Touch can be so powerfully healing. It comprises a significant part of what I offer these men. What exactly do I offer these men? I offer them touch, sure, but I offer them so much more than that. I offer them the chance to explore their desires without judgment or shame. I offer them encouragement, acceptance, and an enthusiastic partner who will delve into their fantasies with them. Often these men have never even expressed their fantasies to another human being before coming to see me. Society says that as a man, they should not desire these things, the very things that they jerk off to, dream about, and long for. So when I slowly slide a pair of silky panties onto their body, fondling their cock and ass through the smooth fabric and remarking how sexy they look, I often get downcast eyes, blushes, and smiles. Embarrassment, yes, but also a smile that speaks wordlessly and loudly of the pleasure of really being seen and accepted for exactly who they are for the first time in their lives. And when I bend them over and pull those panties down just far enough to fuck them with strong, purposeful strokes or gentle, tender thrusts, they get to let everything go and just receive. They are no longer responsible for anything except taking in all the pleasure I deliver and allowing themselves to be vulnerable and open. Allowing themselves to be taken in a way they have usually only taken their partners, but I've never had the opportunity to experience the other side of. I'm a sex worker. Yes, you heard me right. Ruby Ryder is a sex worker. I'll just let that sink in a bit. Wow, so how did that happen? What made me decide to become a sex worker? It happened like this. My passion is pegging. I write about it, teach about it, give advice about it, and write erotica about it. Turns out this is a very popular fantasy amongst men. Usually not one they will openly admit to, but with the anonymity of the internet, they contact me in droves. Often, they discover that prostate stimulation via their ass can give them more pleasure than they have ever experienced. But here are other reasons men become interested in pegging. In a way, I think part of their interest is a reaction to the man box they have been placed in. Society dictates that men always appear strong, in control, confident, and assertive. Appearing weak, not in control, softer, and more passive is forbidden, as is anything that appears feminine or homosexual. I'm not going to even get into how harmful this line of thinking is. It's the very definition of toxic masculinity. But the man box can have a powerful and terribly limiting effect on men's sexuality. In general, men are expected to be the givers of pleasure, the active ones, the penetrators, the ones who run the fuck. Imagine feeling that level of responsibility every time you got in bed. What about the times when you just want to be held and tenderly fucked? What about when you want to express your feminine side and wear panties or pretty lingerie and feel softer or feel taken by a strong, lustful partner? What happens when you just want to switch things up once in a while? There is no easy way to explore those longings, no way which is accepted by the majority of our society anyway. This causes so many men so much shame. I've never seen it as shameful. From the first time I tried pegging about 10 years ago, I have always loved fucking men. It might have helped that my first experience was with a hot fireman. But I love the way their facade of masculinity comes down and pure vulnerability is underneath, and the contrast between the two. I love giving them pleasure and hearing them moan and whimper, and I definitely love being dominant and in control. The ending of my second marriage was like coming out of a sexual desert, so when I started fucking men, I made up for lost time and fucked a bunch of them. I reveled in my newfound sexual jungle. There was no lack of men who wanted to get fucked, so I selected the ones that appealed the most, often the young and pretty. A friend said to me one day, "You know you're giving yourself away, right?" I replied, "What do you mean?" I honestly wasn't sure where she was going with that. What are you getting out of this other than a pretty young man in your bed for the night? You're bringing them so much knowledge, skill, and finesse. You deserve more. And I answered, "Well, okay, but if I took something for it, I'd be a sex worker." I had the usual bad connotations connected to those words and didn't want to go there. Not necessarily. You could be a dom receiving a tribute. Fine line, I thought, but she had a good point. Why not benefit from something I really enjoyed? Isn't that what we all wish for, work that we love? And I was kind of giving it away for free. Plus, the choices I'd made in my life to that point had often left me on the line financially. As much as I loved being a sex educator, making a good income at it was extraordinarily difficult. Some kind of compensation for fucking these men would be nice. So for 3 months, I traded a few men, a thorough fucking, for things like gift certificates for massages or pedicures. And that was good. Then I sat back and asked myself, why am I not just getting paid for this? I love it. I want to do it anyway. I could use the money. Seemed like a no-brainer because my work as a sex educator who specializes in pegging had created a line of men to my front door. I didn't see those men as potential clients, because I wanted to keep my two worlds quite separate, Ruby Rider and sex worker. Guess that ends today. But it did enlighten me as to just how many men there are who wanted to get pegged. I also ran across a post in a pro-doms chat group complaining about how there were so many men lately who just wanted to get pegged with a handjob. These men weren't showing respect for the significant skills these professional women had in bondage, impact play, etc. They were just looking for pegging and release. So, okay, that confirmed that the demand was there. That would be the point where I stepped over the line, quite consciously and with a lot of forethought. I spoke with men who had been to sex workers for pegging. I found a mentor who was a phone sex operator and another who was a semi-retired sex worker. I asked a lot of questions and finally decided to go for it. The universe apparently supported my decision. My very first client was a delightful deja vu of the very first guy I pegged. Another hot fireman. Seriously. When he left, I had a pile of money, a smile on my face, and wet panties. I thought to myself, this is a dream job. I have not looked back since that day. That was about 4 years ago. For me, that initial knee-jerk reaction to the label sex worker is now gone. I'm proud of what I do, and I've made many friends in the sex worker community. I think of it this way. We all deserve to have someone to connect with, and we deserve to be able to explore our safe and consensual fantasies without judgment or shame. For a whole host of reasons, that can be difficult and complicated for many people. As a sex worker specializing in BDSM and pegging, I make that exploration less filled with complications and judgments, and more filled with safety, acceptance, and enthusiasm. I have encountered so much gratitude from my clients. They're profoundly grateful for the safe space I offer them to explore new experiences, ones that are way outside of the box of accepted male sexuality. Why am I telling you I'm a sex worker? Because so many in the sex worker community are suffering. I am an incredibly privileged sex worker. I do not have to do this to survive. I do sex work part-time. I have never experienced violence. What I would label a bad experience has been limited to personality conflicts, bad hygiene, or no-show appointments. When people ask me how I like being a sex worker, this is always what I answer. About 60% of the time, I love it. I'm having a good time. About 20% of the time, it's more like work. Whether it's a personality conflict, poor communication, hygiene, or something like that. And that leaves 20%, right? Those are the clients who, I swear to God, I would so fuck for free. So that's my situation. And as I mentioned, I have so much privilege, it's obscene. Unfortunately, I am the type of sex worker people point to when trying to make the case for decriminalization, the white woman who loves her work. There are so many more of us that do not have the privilege I do, and those sex workers deserve to be heard. People do sex work for a lot of reasons. Some do sex work on a survival level, to put food on the table, pay the rent, to take care of their families. Sometimes they do it because their physical or emotional health leaves them unable to work a job with a regular schedule. And sometimes they do it due to financial desperation. And this is important. Sometimes they hate their work. Before you judge, remember that there are people in every profession who hate their work. Every profession. If you choose to judge a sex worker who hates their job, why are you not judging the police officer who hates their job? Sex workers deserve to work safely, regardless of how much they love or hate their job. So what do sex workers want and need? What we want is the right to choose our own labor and the right to choose what we do with our bodies. Consensual sex work is a victimless crime. Take care not to label all sex workers as victims. We are decidedly not. Most consensual sex workers simply want the right to choose our labor as well as the protections that other workers enjoy. Instead of protection, we get persecution and prosecution. What we need is for you to listen to our stories before you try to save us or assume we are victims. Listen to our stories before deciding what you think we need. Listen to us before passing laws that affect us without even talking with us. If most people in the community you're supposed to be helping loudly oppose the actions you're proposing to save them, you need to take a step back, listen to them, and find a better way. The marginalized in our community have suffered immeasurably, violence and death, after the passage of SESTA-FOSTA. So when presidential candidate Kamala Harris holds up the passage of SESTA-FOSTA as one of her crowning achievements, I want you to understand what really happened. Prior to SESTA-FOSTA, sex workers used the internet to vet new clients, which provided not only more safety, but an independence from pimps and exploiters. This law took away our ability to use the internet, and all the platforms we used to vet clients and share safety information disappeared practically overnight. This forced many sex workers back to the streets and empowered pimps and exploiters, the very people it was supposed to target. San Francisco reported a 170% increase in sex trafficking after the law was passed. Police complain that sex trafficking victims are now harder to find and traffickers are harder to prosecute. No one who is being honest can point to that law and call it a success. So how did this happen? In a supposed attempt to cut down on already fairly minimal sex trafficking, the definition of sex trafficking was ridiculously widened, pretty much including all consensual sex work. This inflated the numbers. For example, a friend who drives a consensual sex worker to an out call for safety reasons was now labeled a sex trafficker. The inflated numbers made it sound like around every corner there were poor children being sex trafficked. So, of course, both houses passed the bill, even though our very own Department of Justice advised against it. These inflated numbers were and are being used to justify federal grants to law enforcement agencies and non-governmental organizations who combat sex trafficking. Consensual sex work is not sex trafficking, and never has been. All we want is the right to choose our own labor and the same protections other workers have. Sex work is work. All consensual sex workers are against sex trafficking, and we ask that you take care to make a distinction between the two. They are not the same. If all the money given to agencies to fight sex trafficking had been used in a focused manner to ferret out sex trafficking instead of a huge dragnet that included all consensual sex work as well, so many more sex trafficking victims could have been saved. Also, more sex traffickers could have been prosecuted. And sex workers could do their jobs without fearing violence and death. Here's one more reason that I am telling you I am a sex worker. Discriminatory feelings against and assumptions about groups of people can be remedied by getting to know them. Personalizing it. What do I mean by that? Let's say I really didn't like white cats, but then I go to a friend's house who has three white cats and I get to know them. I discover through personal interaction that they're perfectly lovely cats, and apparently my assumptions about white cats were incorrect. This is what I have done as Ruby Ryder. That taboo against pegging is strong. The misconceptions and assumptions are numerous. On my podcasts, I share the stories my listeners send in and allow you a glimpse of their lives and loves. You hear about their struggles and successes, their hopes and dreams. And somewhere along the line, you realize they're just people. Perhaps you can even relate to their stories a little. Suddenly, the whole knee-jerk judgmental reaction against people who do pegging lessens. So here I am, the same Ruby Ryder that encourages you to follow your desires, talk to your partners, be loving and compassionate, kind and considerate. I fight against the shame, the ridicule, and the taboo. I offer education and information. Above all, I stand up for your right to be who you are sexually with no shame. And I, Ruby Ryder, am a sex worker. Sex workers are people. We have our struggles and successes too. And when you listen to our stories, I imagine you will judge us less. That knee-jerk reaction will not be so automatic. Perhaps you'll begin to see us as people and realize we deserve the right to choose our labor and the right over our own bodies. And when the subject of decriminalization comes up, maybe you'll think of Ruby Ryder, but hopefully instead, you will think about the marginalized sex workers who need your help far more than I ever will. For them, it is truly a matter of life and death. So there you have it. I'm going to put a link in the Linkorama to a project that is getting funded through GoFundMe, and it is a book that's being written, and what the author is doing is collecting stories from sex workers and asking for donations so that she can pay the marginalized sex workers who really deserve and need to have their stories told, each like $100 for their story. And the more that we fund this, the more these stories are going to be able to get out there, and the more it will reduce the stigma, the more it will personalize it. And once those stories get out there, it will really help everyone else to realize that we are just people. We are people. And this is what we mean when we use the hashtag someone you know is a sex worker, because it's true. We're all hiding because it's illegal. But imagine if all of a sudden you knew that the woman who cuts your hair is a sex worker on the side, or the guy who washes your car is a sex worker on the side. We're out there. We are absolutely out there. And it would be really nice if all of us, every one of us, could enjoy the privileges that I do effortlessly. We need protection. We need sex workers' rights. So I ask you, if you can, to donate to that cause. That will help get the word out. And if you haven't noticed, our presidential candidates are being asked about decriminalization. And so I'm going to close this podcast with some details about what decriminalization means. Usually, if you're not used to thinking about sex workers as people, when the subject of decriminalization comes up, if you're a somewhat sex-positive person, you might say, well, yeah, I think it should not be illegal. It should be okay. It should be legal, but we're going to have to regulate it, and we're going to have to make all these rules that they have to follow, like the health checks and the this and the that. Okay, well, here's what happens when you make any part of trying to legalize sex work mandatory. Like, if you say there's got to be health checks, there has to be, you know, certifications, you have to register, you have to get a permit, you know, things like this, for example, then you're automatically creating another marginalized group of people who can't afford to do those things. And whenever you create a marginalized group of people, you create a vulnerable group of people. What do I mean by that? Well, let's say I'm a sex worker and it is legalized, but I have to go get a permit, I have to do these health checks every so often, and because of whatever reason, I simply can't afford it. Well, then I'm basically working under the law, is what I'm doing, because I don't have my permit. So if I had a client come to me, they could try and force me to do things I didn't want to do, or they could be violent with me, and I'm not going to report it because I'm not working legally. See how that works? Well, that's sort of a little view into what's happening right now on a much bigger scale. Because it is illegal, we can't report things to the police. We can't ask for protection for the violence that is done to us because, since it's illegal, we are, in essence, a marginalized group of people. And people won't listen. Judges will say, well, what do you expect? You're a sex worker. And police are, unfortunately, many times part of the violence that is done against sex workers, sadly. So different countries have tried different approaches to legalization. There is something called the Swedish model. Other people have called it the Nordic model, even though Norway never started this. The Swedish model legalizes sex work, but criminalizes buying it. An awful situation that once again encourages a lot of violence because it breaks down the trust between client and provider. There is no trust at all because it's illegal to buy it. So the Swedish model is something that Kamala Harris alluded to. She used the word decriminalization when she talked about it recently in an interview, and that made headlines and everything, but that's not what she's talking about. She said, well, I think maybe consensual sex work should be legal, but we're really going to have to go over after the Johns. You can't do that. You can't do that because then you create just one more horrible situation that has been proven in other countries not to work. Real decriminalization would look like what New Zealand has. New Zealand has made everything legal except for immigrants coming into the country and becoming sex workers. That they will not allow. And even just that rule has created a subgroup of immigrants who practice illegally because perhaps they're seen as something exotic. If you're a New Zealander and someone from another country comes in and you kind of have exotic tastes and you would like a sex worker who is different than the people who live in New Zealand, then you're going to go for that. But if that's illegal, then you are dealing with another marginalized community because those people have been prohibited against coming into the country and becoming sex workers. So can you see how this situation gets really complicated really fast? And I'm not surprised that many, many people just really don't understand what's going on, and they have the knee-jerk reaction that I did when I first heard those words so long ago and considered doing some sex work. Yeah, that was very much a knee-jerk reaction. And it was something I grew up with. Of course, sex workers are bad. And then I became one. And I have learned so much, and I don't regret a moment of it. Not a moment. So yes, Ruby Ryder is a sex worker. So for those of you who feel moved by everything that I have shared, we would absolutely like your help as an ally to speak up everywhere and anywhere you see people talking trash about sex workers. Speak up for sex workers' rights. Say that consensual sex work is not sex trafficking. Say that we have the right to choose what we do with our own bodies. We have the right to choose our labor. And we have the right to do it safely. Would really, really appreciate some allies being born from this labor of love that I wrote that day up in San Francisco with a cold in a luxury hotel room. Yes. It was nice that I only had to go 2 blocks up and get really delicious Thai food. San Francisco is a fabulous place, and I was right there in the middle of the financial district. It was a reservation that someone else had they couldn't use. They were going to lose it. I took the train up and enjoyed a bunch of days in a luxury hotel up in San Francisco. It was really freaking awesome. And that gave me the space to write this. I felt it was important to come out because, yes, I'm a real person and I'm a sex worker. So thank you, Dan Savage, for the inspiration. And thank you all for listening. I'm not going to be surprised if some of you decide not to listen to me anymore, but I do hope the word spreads and even more of you decide that now you will listen to me. And I do hope that whatever your takeaway is from this, that it's wrapped in kindness and compassion for everyone in our world. Thank you for downloading and listening. You rock. Happy pegging.